Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Professor Sherry Simon of Concordia University about her book Cities in Translation, in which she charts the role of translational practice in the literary developments of four linguistically divided cities, Calcutta, Trieste, Barcelona, and Montreal. In this interview, we discuss the role of plurilingual cities as a site of modernist literature, and consider the ways in which their spatial configurations influence the flow of new ideas, and we consider the possibilities and arguable dangers of self-translation across contested language boundaries. Sherry, how did you come to write this book?
Well, this book actually comes out of a previous book that I wrote on the city of Montreal. And in fact, even in the introduction to this one, I make it quite clear that this is a continuation of the exploration of my experience of Montreal as someone who was born into this particular divided city and is still curious to understand to what extent the situation of Montreal is really singular or not. And I'm not entirely sure that even after this long exploration of three other cities, I've come to a definitive conclusion on that. But my question had to do with how language divisions in the city can be both, of course, a divisive and difficult situation, and on the other hand, an exciting and productive one. And there is something to be said for the idea of what I call productive dissonance in the divided city. So the linguistically divided cities that I look at are not cities like Jerusalem or Beirut. They're not the cities where you have intractable political conflict, because that is obviously a situation where there is going to be little, at least in the period of political conflict, that will be productive, or they'll come about afterwards. I do begin my book Cities in Translation with a discussion of Nicosia, which is a city that is living. It calls itself the last divided capital of Europe, and it is a city where conflict is intensely politicized, and where there is little contact and little productive conflict across the city. But I take this as, let's say, an example that perhaps one day will reveal some happy conclusion, but not at the moment. So, okay, my exploration begins in Montreal, which is a city which historically has been divided spatially as well as linguistically. And that was one of the questions that I wanted to look at. How does language map itself spatially onto the city? And how can you see the cultural history of such cities as cities brought about through translation? So rather than looking at linguistically divided cities as double entities and looking at one side or the other side, my aim was to look at the passages across cities. And the passages across cities are both material, geographical, they involve voyages across the city, and they are linguistic, and that those linguistic passages take many, many different forms. The theoretical question that I wanted to look at in divided cities before I actually discuss the cities that I chose is the question of recognizing the presence and the imaginative power of language in cities. And there's been a huge explosion of writing about the city since, let's say, about the 1980s. I think the city became a very, very attractive scene of exploration in particular because it allowed an exploration of a site which was not national. It was not dealing with national issues. And I think that there was a kind of an exhaustion with the question of the nation at around that time. So cities came as a promising venue for exploration of questions of community, questions of citizenship, questions of belonging. And there's a terrific explosion of such writing with names like Harvey and Sasson and the importance of the work of Walter Benjamin about the city and so many other names, Edward Soja, etc., that I could mention. But what is extraordinary when you look at this library of books is the absence of attention to language. It's as if language is simply taken for granted. Even in, there's a lot of work on Los Angeles, which has a large Spanish-speaking population, but language is simply mentioned, but not drawn out for the ways in which one experiences one city through language. Now, this is the case for both cities like New York or Paris or Toronto, cities that are, generally speaking, multilingual, yet with one dominant language. And four cities that I explore where two strong languages are in competition. So all cities are multilingual. All cities have conflict of languages, have languages in competition, but some more than others.
Just to cut back to the physical aspect of the city, I mean, one striking theme of your work is the way this notion of language is unified with this very physical sense of passing through the cities with its passages and conduits. And you emphasize early on that your focus is on the way that translators influence the circulation of ideas, but in quite a physical sense, would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. So that was what I wanted to show, because to draw attention to the fact that both from the point of view of urban studies and from translation studies. So for urban studies to show that language is very much a part of the city and that language is always moving. Languages are always moving. The linguistic consciousness of cities are always in movement, whether it be for changes of population, diaspora, migration, or simply the weight of languages change as political and ideological and socio-demographic features change. So you have very often in the kind of city that I'm speaking about where two languages are in competition, you have two different kinds of languages in competition. So you have sort of more vehicular languages, which are languages that don't provoke a sense of strong attachment, and vernacular languages, which are a kind of emergent national languages. And so you have the conflict between these two kinds of languages. And translators turn out to be, you know, wonderful guides to following how languages move in this city. So I sort of devised a method that I began with in my book on Montreal, which was to look at the translators, watch them to see where do they live, what are they doing, how is their work in translation. And here I'm talking about translators who have, a sense of a strong cultural project. So less than a translator who has just been asked to do something. I'm looking at translators who have a sense of themselves as cultural mediators and who intervene in the life of their city. And so in this sense, the translator is often something else as well, a writer, a journalist, someone who has, as I say, a cultural project. So look at the translators. What are they doing? Who are they? How does their trajectory reveal something about how language relationships are changing in the city?
And the particular kind of cultural project that's often the product of this productive dissonance that you talk about is quite typically a modernist strand of literature arising out of the dual city in your work. Is that a particularly natural development, do you find?
Well, it certainly works for the cities that I've looked at, and I'm talking about a certain kind of a time frame. I'm talking about a time frame from, let's say, about the 1880s until, let's say, the end of the millennium. I looked at four cities, and two of them were cities whose modernity I was exploring was one that came about the turn of the century, and then two other cities whose modernity was more in the 50s and 60s. But this seems to be a pattern. It has to do with a kind of national consciousness that emerges in the city. It has a different kind of a valence in the city, especially in cosmopolitan cities like Montreal or Trieste. But they are nationalist projects, and they react to a pre-existing, more cosmopolitan imagination which the city had. So this kind of a modernity, yes, it seems to. I'm sure there are other plenty of other examples we could look at, and there would be different time frames. But modernity, in the way I use it, it sort of stands in for this kind of productive energy, a certain kind of energy of renewal, which I can relate to the kind of cultural renaissances that took place in the late 19th century, and a similar kind of renaissance that seems to take place in cities like Montreal and Barcelona in the 1960s.
On that point, you make the distinction in your introduction between furthering and distancing as two of the possible kinds of consequence of the linguistically conflicted city. Would it be fair to say that these developments are mostly arising out of furthering, which is perhaps not the typical case, or maybe it only arises in certain more cosmopolitan environments?
Yes. Yes. This is a distinction that I introduce and make it quite clear from the beginning that I'm more interested in furthering than I am in distancing. So there's a great deal of translation that has as its social force. I'm talking about the social force of translations, lest they're in some sense their aesthetic workings out. But the social force of translation in many, many cases is what I call distancing. And I've recently found another word for it, or found another analogy for it, which is tolerance. Kind of you translate so that one becomes familiar with another culture, but nothing changes in the relationships between the two cultures. So one takes cognizance of another culture, one learns that it exists, but in some senses, that only augments the rift between them, and you realize how distant you are from that culture. That's something, it's a little bit like tolerance. I recognize that you're different. I will tolerate your difference. But tolerance is really, you know, the lowest common denominator there is. We want something more than tolerance. We want real engagement with difference. We want something to happen in the relation with another culture. So that's where furthering becomes more like finding new ways of understanding difference, and where the terms of engagement are actually altered by the encounter with the other. So in the kinds of translation that I refer to, which is furthering, there is something is unbalanced, there's a disequilibrium introduced, which changes the relationship between the cultures in question and involves a movement towards. In the case of the both Barcelona and Montreal, it's a movement towards the vernacular, the national vernacular, the Catalan in Barcelona, or French in Montreal.
You make that distinction between tolerance and something more productive. It reminds me rather of the debates about multiculturalism and whether that is what we wish to aspire to, or whether we want something more than that. Does it tie up with that?
Absolutely. In fact, my initial interest in Montreal came from the kinds of disturbances that were the discourses around multiculturalism and belonging in Quebec, and in particularly in Montreal in the 1980s. And multiculturalism has revealed itself to be a very limited way of thinking about belonging in our cities, multiculturalism being very close to yes, what you would call tolerance or my idea of translation as distancing. And what I'm trying to get at are the kinds of changes that I've actually observed and that I observe in all the cities that I've studied, which involve different ways of relating to language, different ways of a more generalized belonging that come about through translation. So come about through what I call these warmer or more intense forms of translation, which are a condition of citizenship for today's cities, because there must be a common language, but the common language can't be forced or imposed. There have to be kinds of translation which come about through the processes of a common citizenship.
So turning to the four cities that you discuss in detail in your book, 19th century Calcutta, Habsburg, Trieste, post-Franco Barcelona, and late 20th century Montreal, they're spread across space and time. Do you see strong commonalities stretching across that space and time?
I at first was looking for cities like Montreal, which are marked by spatial divisions. So I realized that I was talking about, or I was looking at, the spatial divisions of colonialism. If you look at the history of colonial cities, British and French colonial cities, especially of the 19th century, you see a common spatial configuration, and that is that there's an indigenous city in some senses that's pre-existing, not exactly the case for Calcutta, but pre-existing indigenous city, and then a European enclave, which is superimposed upon the indigenous city, which results in a kind of black town, white town configuration, which was most specifically seen in Calcutta, but in French Morocco, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens when you see this spatial division? Of course, it calls for translation, because these spatial divisions are also linguistic divisions. Who crosses those lines? How do they cross lines? How do cultures and languages cross those lines? This was my sort of beginning question. But then I looked at other cities came to appear just as important. Trieste has some similarities with the colonial configuration, but not the spatial one. So Trieste is a Habsburg city, has much in common, even though it's an atypical, very atypical Habsburg city. It had some very important aspects of the Habsburg city, which is that German is a colonial and proto-colonial, it's an imperial situation technically, but a proto-colonial administrative overlay of German over what is the indigenous language, if you like, which is Italian in the case of Trieste. But you can look at Prague or Budapest or many, many other cities and see a similar configuration. So what was common to the cities was this duality, was the fact that you had two strong languages fighting it out in the scene of the city, but the spatial configurations are different. Barcelona finally is different as well. It's not a colonial configuration where you have Catalan lined up on one side and Castilian on the other, but you rather you have sort of pockets. So what I used in the terms speaking about Barcelona was the idea of passages that go through the city, kind of secret passageways, which do actually exist in the city, but that which you can sort of understand imaginatively as the passages of secret languages through the city, because Barcelona was a city where Catalan was, for the long period of Franco's dictatorship, prohibited from the city and has only recently reemerged. So your question was, what's common to these cities? Very briefly, just recap. So they have two strong languages fighting it out on the terrain of the city, but the spatial configurations are different.
So turning first to Calcutta, you discussed the Bengali Renaissance in the context of various preceding failed attempts to bridge across that language divide, or maybe not failed is too strong, but maybe not fully realized attempts. The first of which circles around this rather picturesque figure of Herasim Lebedev.
Yes, he's a fantastic character, and I wish I knew more about him as well. In fact, lots of people do, because he was a very colorful guy, and he was actually expelled from Calcutta as a result of some of his entrepreneurial ideas, and it's not sure if he was a spy or if people were simply jealous of him. But he had very, very early, when he arrived in Calcutta, and we're talking about the end of the 18th century, he had the idea of translating theater from English into Bengali, something that was kind of totally unheard of. And I like exploring these ideas of what's unheard of or what's unthinkable or unthought of at a certain time. You know, what is translatable at in certain situations and what is not translatable. So the idea of translating theater from English into Bengali at that time was literally unthinkable. He was the first one to suggest it. He was also wonderfully inventive in terms of his musical, inventing hybrid forms of musical composition, hybrid forms of decor, using traditional Bengali designs as well as European ones, and using the proscenium stage. So it would have been so wonderful to have an actual recording of what his translation and this performance might have looked like. In the end, he was able to only put on a certain number of performances, and then he was run out of town. So his idea of translating from English to Bengali at this very early stage stands as a kind of a road not taken. It would take many decades until something like that could be successfully enacted. He was also Russian, and that might have something to do with the fact that he had an idea which might not have occurred since the cultural rift between Bengali and the British, who were becoming more and more of a strong administrative presence in the city at that time. Maybe because he was Russian, he could do something. But he stands as a wonderful example of what is unthinkable, what can be done despite unthinkable, and stand as a kind of model which would later be taken up. But the other thing about Lebedev that was so interesting is that he was actually a linguist and used the Bengali that he translated into was a particular hybrid form as well. He wrote a book and he became one of the first to become interested in hybrid forms of contact language in India. So as a linguist, he was also important.
A second intermediate figure you discuss, whose legacy is rather more contested, perhaps, is that of James Long. I wonder how do you see his contribution in the benefit of hindsight?
I was for a long time very puzzled about James Long. He was Irish, born Irish, and spent most of his life in Calcutta. And what inspired me most about James Long is that he was truly a citizen of Calcutta. He loved the city. He explored it and studied it in ways that no one had done before him. He was actually an inventor of the social sciences in Calcutta. He founded a number of important associations which dealt with the social sciences. He was profoundly sympathetic to Bengali culture, and yet he was a missionary. So hard to figure out exactly how to situate such an individual. He comes to our attention first because he's actually jailed by the British authorities, ostensibly for having translated a subversive text about the indigo planters. This was a big controversy in India, especially in Calcutta in around 1861. And this followed the Sepoy Rebellion, or what's known as the first Indian Rebellion, in the late 50s. And so the British were worried about any kind of possible subversive act. So In fact, James Long did not translate the work that he was supposed to have, but he was associated with it. And the British understood that, and they actually put him in jail. He, a British citizen, was jailed by the British authorities, which made him an instant and long enduring hero of Bengali culture. So he really occupied this marvelous space between his identity as a European and a British person, and his great sympathy for Bengali culture. So what does that mean in terms of translation? He was a great, great believer in translation into Bengali. He promoted translation, and he promoted certain kinds of translation. So he promoted translation of the Bible into Bengali, but also he wanted novels and all kinds of other works translated into Bengali. The question ultimately becomes, what is the real benefit of these translations? They were done under the aegis of the religious authorities. They were chosen as appropriate for Bengalis. And yet they were translated into Bengali. They promoted the Bengali language and therefore gave the language the capacity, the genetic capacity to reproduce itself, or, I mean, they aided it. It would have got there anyway, but they aided the Bengali language in being set up as a language having adequate resources to express many kinds of reality. So James Long, and just one more thing about James Long, which is sort of just perfect for my particular purposes. At one point, he actually set up house in the intermediary zone between the British and the Bengali parts of the city. He actually lived in the central part with a Bengali priest. So he really did sort of set himself up as an intermediary between the two cultures and was extremely effective. But as I say, what are the effects finally of the kinds of translation he did, of the control that he exercised over translation? He believed that translation was a kind of, should be adapted always towards Bengali values, and so that they would be immediately assimilatable. And yet there was a kind of a civilizing pedagogical aim behind his work. So I think there's something very instructive about the ambiguities of James Long, the fact that he worked for the British, that he did this amazing work of studying the print culture of Bengalis, prepared a report, which even today stands as an important report on Bengali publishing. He was the only one who really could do this, who really understood exactly what was happening on the ground. But in the end, this report also had kind of very important surveillance functions. So what to say about this kind of a project of translation? And I think this is an interesting, there's an interesting analogy, if I can just skip forward to my work on Montreal. Again, it would take me a moment to set it up, but there's a Francophone who translates from Yiddish into French, which had never been done before. And he does this with extremely laudatory aims and with very important political results. Yet, this enterprise of translation at the same time ends up serving the power situation of French nationalism in Quebec. I can explain that in a moment. But central to both enterprises of translation is that they're immensely important. They're undertaken with the best of intentions, but in the end, they have ambiguous results. That is to say, that they could serve interests which are in some ways contrary to the intentions that they represent.
It's then in many ways a less controversial figure who dominates the latter part of your chapter on Calcutta and the Bengali Renaissance, that of Bankimchandra Chatterjee, who you credit with, in effect, translating the concept of the novel into Bengali and thus into other Indian languages.
Yes, he's as I mentioned at the beginning, he's very much a giant, and he's someone who has become consecrated as the great figure of Bengali nationalism, the consecration of Bengali nationalism in the form of the novel written in Bengali. Bankim is a very interesting figure. Again, you know, follow the translator, see what the translator can show you about what's happening in the culture. He was, as they say, a textbook embodiment of the ambivalence of the individual and the culture at the time. He was someone who one of the first Bengalis to get a BA. He became an important administrator in the British. In the British administration. At the same time, he was a great reader of Sanskrit, a great believer in Hindu nationalism. And what he managed to do was to translate the form of the novel. So this Calcutta in the late 1860s is an intense contact zone. Even if the two areas of the city are separate, even if there's not maybe a lot of traveling between material traveling between the two, there's a tremendous amount of cultural traveling. The book is absolutely essential. There's a great book culture in Bengal, and you have a lot of the or at least a significant part of the Bengali population reading in English. So Bankim is reading in English and thinking about what he's going to write. And his first novel, called Raj Mohan's Wife, he actually writes in English, but it's a flop. It doesn't work. And critics are pretty clear on the fact that it doesn't work because he doesn't really know who he's writing for. And then Bankim understands that it's not only the language he must deal with, but he must in some way displace himself and displace the form that he's working with. And he decides to start writing novels in Bengali. There had never been such thing as the form of the novel in Bengali. He writes works that are significantly different from what the novel is in English, and he transforms it at the same time. But he does found something which is called the novel in Bengali, and which becomes hugely successful immediately and hugely translatable. His works were translated, but also the novel form, after he had sort of initiated it, became translated into all the other languages in India. The major languages adopted the novel form in a kind of magical and simultaneous moment of reproduction. So Bankim's hesitations, his own personal ambivalence, his own ambivalence with regard to values as well. He's both someone who would be very sort of traditional in his personal ways, the food he ate, the places he lived in, he would change. At some times he would be religious, other times he wouldn't care. He's just a fascinating example of this kind of ambivalence, and his ability to translate himself kind of back and forth. Because I shouldn't make it sound like he only does one thing. He continues to write letters in English. But he writes the novel in Bengali. His personal sort of embodiment of the border, if you like, has spectacular consequences. And then you know, that story becomes the story that is told and becomes kind of the centerpiece of Bengali literary nationalism. Now, this whole movement, this whole story that I've just told, will be central to the way Bengali culture thinks about itself, both adopting this idea and criticizing it. So a lot of the post-colonial critique, which we've seen in the 1960s, 1980s, critiques Ban Ki-moon and this sort of miraculous switch from one to the other, seeing it sometimes as too exclusively Hindu, excluding Muslim realities, excluding women. It's a narrative which is both central and also critique. But translation and self-translation are central to this question of who is Bengali, who becomes Bengali, how does the Bengali language evolve in very different ways, of course, from the other stories that we've just talked about, James Long and Lebedev.
The theme of self-translation is one that resurfaces periodically in a work and is one I'd like to come back to. But it seems natural to me to link the topic of reading in one language, a prestige language, and writing in another language, the local established language, with the topic of your next chapter, that of Trieste, where a similar situation is prevailing with German cultural influences coming in and a distinctively local non-German end product being created from them.
Yes, indeed. This pattern of reading in X, writing in Y, is something that I think could probably be explored in many other contexts. But certainly in Trieste, this becomes the main filter through which I look at someone who's not normally considered a translator, but I call him one because I use this model, and that's the Italian novelist Italo Svevo. Svevo is especially known for one particular novel called La coscienza di Zeno, or called, it's been variously translated as The Confessions of Zeno or The Conscience of Zeno. And this novel and Svevo himself encapsulate some of the tensions that prevailed in the very fruitful, dissonant, difficult period as they approach the event of what becomes known as the redemption of Trieste in 1918. That is the so-called return, although I don't think Trieste actually ever was a part of the adherence of Trieste to Italy. Trieste is an incredibly atypical city. It's a city which was culturally Italian always, but for 400 years, Trieste was a German language administrative city. It was under the Habsburg Empire from the 1400s to 1918, so for a very, very long time. And Svevo, whose real name was Ettore Schmitz, which is as hybrid as the name as Italo Svevo. Italo Svevo is Italo the Swabian, Ettore Schmitz, Hector Schmitz, was born a Jew in Trieste. And at the time, to succeed in any administrative or commercial work, you needed to know German. So his father sent him to study in German. Yet, when he returned to Trieste, Svevo wanted to be a writer in Italian because there was no other way to be a writer in Trieste at that time. To be a Triestine writer was to write in Italian. Yet, Italian was a foreign language, doubly foreign because the real language of citizenship in Trieste is the dialect called Triestino. Then you have another complicating factor, which is the fact that right next to Trieste, Trieste sits on the border with Slovenia. So you have Slovenian and Croatian, which are also important languages in the city. So writing in Italian, reading in German. It becomes a lot of recent research has shown to what extent Svevo was trained in German and had a lot of German philosophical predilections. He read Schopenhauer. He was very, very attached to Schopenhauer. He was very attached to Freud. So Trieste was the gateway of German ideas into Italy. And as a novelist, Italo Svevo invented a new genre, similar in certain ways to Bankim, we could say. He didn't invent the novel, but he invented a certain kind of psychological novel which had not existed in the Italian context. And he did this by translating from German, by translating himself, his language, literally, because he was someone who was known to actually speak, use German expressions, but a certain kind of novelistic consciousness into Italian. Now, the novel, The Conscience of Zeno, is really a remarkable novel. It's funny, it's entertaining, it's witty, it's got a tremendously attractive, I mean, I recommend it to anyone. It's one of the great, great European novels. Italo Svevo was a good friend of James Joyce. It was, in fact, James Joyce who made him famous. And there are affinities between the two writers in their inventiveness, in their psychological innovativeness. And to read Svevo's novels as translations from the German is to allow one to understand to what extent he was able to use the elements of one culture to innovate in a second one. Particularly interesting, as a PS here, is the influence of Freud and the influence of psychoanalysis. Freud was introduced into Italian in Trieste. He was translated by Eduardo Weiss, who was a friend of the circles in which Svevo himself circulated. And Svevo's novel uses Freud and uses uses psychoanalysis as a structuring device.
Now, your chapter on Barcelona is subtitled The Cracked Mirror of Self-Translation, and you discuss in particular Carme Riera's translational practices in writing in Catalan and revising in Castilian and so on. A theme that also recurs throughout throughout your work is the idea that people who self-translate are sometimes criticized for aspects of authenticity which are perceived to be lacking or which are perceived to be discarded in those auto-translations. Why do you think that is?
Yes, I think there's an aspect of self-translation that's very interesting. I think it's the idea that self-translation is a kind of a black box. There's no former text that people can check. In fact, I think that's probably one of the reasons why translators are often suspect in the first place, is that people don't have access to the mysterious process of the conversion from one language to the other. And that's even more marked in the question of self-translations, because what's happening? How are these cultures put together? Self-translations do give rise to suspicion. I think the most virulent kind of suspicion has been addressed to the Yiddish writer I.B. Singer, who won the Nobel Prize and who is, of course, a beloved writer for so many people. And yet for many people who, or for some who are readers of the original Yiddish, and it's particularly the Yiddish that he wrote when he lived in Europe, he is accused of diminishing, diluting, not being faithful to that culture, but yet trying to sell himself to a new culture. I think that's part of it as well, is the idea of this popularity, how you sell yourself, how you promote your writing to the detriment, perhaps, of the culture to which you owe that. And that comes across as well in another example, which is Rabindranath Tagore, who won the Nobel Prize in 1913 for his self-translations from Bengali. And that's remained a source of great controversy in regard to how he did that. And it's often been suggested that W.B. Yeats, who was the editor and prefacer of that collection, in a sense, made Tagore into more of a mystical writer than he was, and didn't convey the modernism of Bengali culture, which Tagore was an inventive, modern, absolutely not traditional or mystic writer at all. So he was, in a sense, misrepresenting himself, and that earned him the Nobel Prize. That's a pretty good way of, it's good he got the Nobel Prize. We like that. But one can understand that that there would be objections to this to this idea of translation as misrepresentation of oneself. Now, in the Barcelona context, I think it's slightly different. But the writer that I'm referring to, Carme Riera, is very aware of how translation, and how could it not be, is a formative key to understanding the culture of the city of Barcelona and the evolving Catalan Castilian question. And she, being a postmodern writer, she poses the question in almost Borgesian ways. I mean, in ways that remind us of Borges. What's first? Who gets an idea? How does it get translated? So she tells a very interesting story of it's a tale, it's a parable of two good friends. One writes some poetry in Catalan. His friend translates him into Spanish. That doesn't do well. On the other hand, the translation, there's another translation, which is a next step, which is back a further collection, which is back into Spanish, that does do well. I mean, what is popular? What is new for a culture, and what is taken up as something original? And in the end, her point is that the profoundly original thinker, a poet, is not recognized as such. The derivative one, the one who is kind of copied from his friend, is recognized as brilliant because what he presents to that other language seems new and important to it at the same time. But what happens in the process is that original and copy get entirely mixed up, and nobody knows any longer which is the original, who is first, who comes later. And I think that's, interestingly, she bases this parable on two real authors who actually did have this situation, live this situation in the 1960s or 70s. So it's quite fascinating to think that these kinds of relationships actually do happen across the borders. But the fact that translation, self-translation, questions of betrayal, questions of secrecy, these become master keys to talking about Barcelona culture make a great deal of sense. We're talking about two languages that are in many ways equal in power, Catalan having had a strong basis in a manufacturing culture, which remains strong, Spanish being the language of the country as a whole, but of Spanish immigrants who immigrated into Barcelona in the 1960s. Some say they were driven to do so by Franco, who was looking to dilute Catalan culture. So there's already a very contestatory relationship between these languages. And yet they look at each other every day. They confront each other every day across the spaces of Barcelona. They're mirrors of each other. They're languages that are very similar physically, visually, Sometimes it's just one letter that's different between the two. This is a relationship that is truly specular, which is the mirror, which is the who's looking at whom. And the possibilities of betrayal, of course, are huge in the sense that we know that there was this political imbalance, that one language was for a long time prohibited, that there's a long history of resentments and secrets that that went into the culture. You know, one would think that the fact that two languages are close to each other would make translatability easier. But in fact, sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes languages that are too close can't be translated. And I have a sort of one particularly sinister illustration of that. There's a very well-known speech that Kafka gave to a theater audience. Kafka was someone who spoke German but was very, very interested, became fascinated by the Yiddish language. And he was very involved with the Yiddish theater group in Prague. And for one of their performances, he addressed the audience ahead of time, and he said, "Don't be worried about the Yiddish language. In fact, you really understand more than you think you do. Just close your eyes and try and understand it. On the other hand," he said, "be careful, because there is a big difference between the two languages." And he used two words. He said, "Tot is not tot, death is not death." And he said, "Blut is not blut," which is blood is not blood. And went on to talk about how the German language would in fact eat or take over the Yiddish language. Or there is a, so there's a sort of very sinister premonitions of what might come. But he said, "You may understand the language, you may think you understand the language, but be careful that when you translate, you're not that you can't really translate, because one language is stronger than the other one." So too much similarity between languages can be an obstacle to translation.
You turn finally to your home city, Montreal. Earlier in the book, you touch on the sense of translating a city using its reference points to describe another city. And you give an example, I think, in which Mexico City is used to describe Chicago. Do you feel that your experience of your own city conditions the way you analyze plurilingual city spaces?
For sure. Because the questions that I came to, the questions that motivate my work, come from my own growing up in a city where I belonged to the stronger language group, not the more numerous, but the stronger language group, but at the same time was immensely attracted to understanding, to crossing the city, to adventuring into the terrain of the more numerous language group, and yet understood that, if you like, structurally, I was not welcome. So there was this combination of fear and attraction, and of a kind of the difficult affects that are involved in living in such a situation of language division. Over the years, I've seen the situation change a great deal. I've seen some fascinating examples of translation which have had extraordinary social and political effects. This has been the source of my interest in looking at passages across the city, to see that passages across the city do have effects, that language relationships are always in a situation of change. And I think that's why translation is such an interesting and important way of trying to grasp those, because there's always a directionality. So it's not simply, I'd like to make a distinction between what I call the multi the multilingual city and the translational city. So all cities are multilingual, as I said, so all cities can be seen as agglomerations of languages. But if you look at it as a city as a translational city, you'll see that the relations among these languages are always moving. So there's a directionality, translating from where to where, from Hindi into English, but from English into Hindi, probably not a great deal in, let's say, Toronto. From English into French, from French into English. So there's directionality, which is always promoting these changes and changing the relationships of languages one to the other. I mean, Montreal is perpetually in a state of contested languages. Which languages, you know, how is English doing with regard to French? These things are being monitored all the time. But in all cities, everywhere, these relationships are changing all the time. The relative power of the dominant language, the relative power of the minority languages, Spanish in the United States, for instance, this is an ongoing situation. Who's translating from what to what? How is citizenship being redefined through these relationships? So Montreal is my starting point, but and a very fertile one, I think. But you know, the questions that I'm asking can be applied to cities across the world.
Let me conclude then by asking, in your last chapter, you present a historical synopsis of Montreal in which it's clear that a great deal more development, more translation, more furthering is taking place than has historically been the case, even when there were certain very productive modernist cultural movements going on. What is the focus for your research now? What particularly draws you to explore further?
Two things. I think that I'd like to continue my exploration of Montreal and update a lot of the questions that I've been looking at in relation to languages of immigration. So where is Arabic today on the city map? I gesture to these questions in my last chapter without developing them as well as I could have. I have looked at, languages of the Mediterranean, Italian, Portuguese, how they did in the city, how they brought a certain kind of cultural élan, especially Italian in the 1960s has been very important to Quebec culture. But what's happening now with relation to South Asian languages, with relation to Arabic, North American cities are cities of migration. So are European cities now. I think it's very important that we understand the relationship among languages in terms of the changing relationships of power and the regard that is given to these languages as they are languages in translation. So what are we going to gain from the cultures that are investing in the most positive ways our cities in Europe and North America? But I have another area that I would like to investigate, and that's Central European cities, especially Central European cities in the period before the Holocaust. So one of the cities that I've become interested in now is a city called Chernivtsi, which is now in the Ukraine, but was the easternmost city of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Interesting in its relationship to Trieste, which was one of the most westernmost cities of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So Chernivtsi was very much a German language city in an area very far away from Vienna, highly literary conscious, similar in many ways to Trieste for the very important literary culture that it spawned, Paul Celan, Rose Auslander, Aaron Affelfeld, and a large number of important writers. So to investigate this city and the translational relationships that happened in the 1920s and the 1930s might give us some understanding of how these cities were multicultural, vibrantly differentiated cities, whose history was in some ways, what can we say, ambushed by the events of the 1930s and 40s.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project, both looking back and looking forward. But for the time being, I must just say, Sherry Simon, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking to Sherry Simon about Cities in Translation. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thanks for listening.